Welcome to LOA Today. I'm Walt Thiessen here with Louis D'Souza. This is your daily dose of happy, and we are so happy you decided to join us today. Amy is not able to make it. She'll be back next week. She's meeting with a book publisher today, so we're hopeful that's going to actually turn into something really good for her, but we'll find out about that next week. This week, though, Louis, you and I have some emails to answer. We've been getting messages.
Sounds good.
Yeah, messages from listeners. From Deborah, and there's another one from, I think it's from Sarah. Let me just double check. Yes, from Sarah. And they're both kind of lengthy. So I'll read you the first one and we can talk about it. And then we'll do the same thing with the second one. That'll probably take us through most of the show just doing that. Knowing how
well,
we go.
Maybe not.
Well, you never know. Anyway, here's what Deborah had to write. This is about last week's show. She says, that was a wonderful discussion. Loved it. Many thanks to the three of you. All of you brought so much to the discussion. The different spices and ingredients you each threw into the mix made for extremely satisfying and richly layered cake. Amy's story was so interesting and inspiring. I was transfixed by the woods behind her, so reminiscent of the witchy woods on a particular section of the Camino de Santiago. I felt very called to tell her about it. I would love to know if she's done the Camino, as I know she'd absolutely love it. I can't answer that question. We'll have to ask her next week. And yes, so agreed with Louis's version of falling in love, and that focusing exclusively on how you felt and what you perceived in those first heady, intoxicating, giddy days when everything glowed and sparkled with such intensity, particularly your beloved, by replicating and maintaining that feeling and that focus in the ensuing, quote, leaving the loose seed up, not replacing the lids on the jet, on the jars or on the toothpaste, unquote, years. What a wonderful partnership, and when extended to all life it can be. The concept of self-love feels huge here too, she says, partly because if we're always seeing ourselves mirrored in others and are truly learning to love and see the depth and beauty within us, then that is what we'll perceive in all around us. What we're falling in love with anyway is the essence of what we all are, that source connection that supersedes and embraces all. It seems to me that the aversion we all innately have to the concept of mirror work is because we think we're being called to become preeningly self-absorbed, full of ourselves, while simultaneously fearing that we may find with what we may find within us. Whereas it's actually a massive leap into that mostly unknown realm of pure and unconditional love. It's something I'm experiencing very powerfully as I'm going through the mirror work process. By the way, I don't know if I told you, she took that up about a week ago, something like that. And after 2 days, she reported a huge increase in a huge, powerful response for herself.
You had a lot of success with that too.
Oh, tons of it. Yeah, we can go into that in a minute. She says, what I thought of as a hideous process of introspection and fawning self-adulation is the exact opposite. Yes, you fall in love with yourself, but the personal aspect of that is almost irrelevant. It's like, and indeed is, I feel falling in love with life, with that source connection. And then she writes in quotes, mind the gap. Oh, I love that Louis brought this up. When I lived in London, for some reason, I always loved hearing that announcement. Just put it down to my quirky weirdness, but now it feels like it was an exhortation from source telling us to be mindful of that peace-filled state within us. So London Transport is, in fact, deeply spiritual. Pretty cool. What do you think?
Tell that to the million unhappy commuters.
Funny thing about those unhappy commuters.
Mind the gap.
Funny thing about them is, and this would not make them feel any better, they chose to be unhappy. I'm just pointing that out.
No. It's this guy who decided to jump in front of the train. He's delaying us. Just can't stand the guy anymore. The amount of times you hear that announcement is like,
Well, you know, it's like anything else where the ARAS is concerned. We can filter it to let it in, or we can filter it to keep it out. Just depends what we give our attention to. I mean, it's like anything that you do on a regular basis. If you just kind of filter it out, you don't even see it or hear it anymore.
I'll give you a little bit of a history about transport in South Africa. Is the only time I ever went on a train in the entire time I lived in South Africa for 27 years was in the army. The army shuffled us around on a train. And when I came to London and I saw all these beautiful trains and tubes, and pretty much running on time and all the rest of it, I was thinking, my God, this is just amazing. Wow. This is incredible. And then everybody's bitching about it. It's like, come on, guys, you don't realize what you got. You have no idea.
Right? Yeah, that's true.
No idea what you got. And I found that a common thing is, you know, because contrast is a teacher, isn't it? If it's on time every day and it's 1 minute late the next day, then you bitch, you know.
Yeah.
It's a contrast.
We are creatures of habit. We're used to having stuff play out the same way it always plays out. I mean, that's how most of our programming works. It's based on a tape that just keeps playing over and over again. Every day I wake up, I go to eat breakfast. After I get dressed and I feed the cats. I mean, it's just the same thing over and over and over again. And when our routines get thrown out of whack, we notice, and many of us don't like it very much. So we tend to react.
You know what? Somebody said on a Facebook the other day, they said, what do you see when you look in the mirror? So I immediately wrote down, it's a very spiritual group, this. I immediately wrote down a handsome guy.
Ooh, nice. Very nice. Bravo.
And, I really thought that was the best thing I could put in that spiritual group.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. What made that come up? I'm kind of curious. Were they talking about mirror exercises?
No, they weren't. To engage the group, they often put up questions to get reactions from everybody. And this is just something that popped up. And I was like, I remember Walt's mirror exercises. And the interesting thing about your mirror exercises is that I've been, from as young as I remember, looking in the mirror and just really liking what I see, always have. So kind of realized that I've never really had that kind of issue. I don't think mirror exercises would do anything for me. I'm not so much in love with myself, but I have a huge respect for my body. And I've got a appreciation for my mind, although the appreciation is lessening hugely, because I'm starting to realize you really want to get to the source mind and not the human mind. The human mind just regurgitates all the time. So my respect for it has gone down in leaps and bounds recently, more and more.
Oh my.
To the degree that I'm now really looking for the gap more than I'm looking for intellectual discussions or, you know, I went on a philosophy group the other day again, and it just left me stone cold arguing such arbitrary concepts of nothingness and going nowhere fast. And just like, it's like back at my student days when I was getting so bored with the whole thing.
Are you still doing the Speakers Bureau?
Speakers Corner.
Or Speakers Corner, excuse me.
Speakers Corner shut down because of COVID. But
They don't have a virtual version. Okay.
No. Nobody's got a virtual version of that. Although I might make something like that, but it's going to be very different in context than a philosophy group. Starting to see the that it's a good step for people, but you eventually go way past the idea of having intellectual conversations. And you kind of get more into experiencing and finding out, and touching source is of far greater value than endlessly discussing them, it's in its different manifestations. Really, what you start getting to the point of is realizing that you're a vibrational interpreting machine, and you just want to tune your station to different stations. It's like, that's the most exciting thing.
Mm-hmm, that's
true. What station shall we play with today?
Right. Yeah. Well, you're raising a couple of interesting points, though, and I'm kind of putting them in juxtaposition to each other, and I want to get your reaction on it. Because on the one hand, you're talking about how you, in effect, were doing mirror work for years without really intending to do mirror work. It's just you kind of did it naturally. And so you didn't really think there's going to be any great value in that. And then you immediately followed up by talking about how your respect for the mind had fallen off dramatically. I'm not sure if you said falling off a cliff, but it was something that dramatic. Mm-hmm. And yet, to me, that creates an interesting juxtaposition, because when I look in the mirror, part of what I see is my mind. I mean, I see myself, you know, looking back at me, and I think of myself in terms of my heart and my mind, the whole me. So I'm wondering, what makes you think that you are? Well, first, let's take it one step at a time. Why are you saying that you think that your respect for the mind is falling off? You kind of touched on that, but let's reiterate. And then if you're seeing your respect fall off, why wouldn't mirror work help with that?
Okay, so when you look into the mirror and you see your thoughts, is that your mind?
They certainly take place in the mind.
So remember what Abram says, that what you do is you still the mind. And after you've stilled the mind, you touch source. And once you touch source, source could speak to you. And you could perceive that as words, but it's it's not quite words. It's more a feeling of well-being and direction, etc., and it could bring in images, etc., which, of course, go through the mind. But I'm now talking about, I don't know, in the old spiritual world, we used to talk about the little mind and the source mind, or the spiritual mind or the soul mind in the old words. So my respect for the little mind, which really just brings up memories of what I've thought of before and maybe massages them into slight difference, variation, and my faculty of dreaming of what I want, those two faculties, because most of my life and even most of my mind at the moment is not specifically clearly focused on what I want. It is just regurgitating a lot of stuff which is of absolutely close to zero value.
Okay.
So we have a psychological drama going on in our head. And you're either a great director or you're a terrible one.
Not a lot of gray area, huh?
You're right. You're either creating a horror movie, which most people are doing.
Yes.
All right. Or you're creating your dream world where you want to go. And most people aren't particularly focused on their dream world. So because they're not good directors and they're creating horror movies, they're having a really torturous life. So I'm starting to realize that I'm not that interested in that little mind anymore, that one that regurgitates the old thoughts, the old patterns, the old ideas. And I'm now really focused on tapping into the power that creates worlds so that I can start blowing things open and moving forward with great enthusiasm and energy, not necessarily manifesting hugely physical for everybody else to see, but my inner world becoming much richer and much more exciting.
And just reiterate something for me here, because I mean, I know you kind of defined it, but to me, there's not a huge difference between the two. So it's not something I would tend to label the way you're labeling it. That's why I'm asking. But you're distinguishing between the small mind and I guess what we'll call the big mind or the expansive mind.
Or source energy mind.
Or the source energy mind, yeah. And I guess my question
is... And I would even remove the word mind. It's kind of so big and unfathomable that to even use the word mind is limiting on a massive scale.
Oh, well, then that takes away my question. Okay. Then you go right ahead with what you were saying.
And, of course, to use words for it is... Society and even most of the self-help books and all the rest of it don't elaborate much on that non-physical source energy arena. And it is very indefinable, and it is where you came from before you're born. It is where you'll go when you die. and, you know, it encompasses everything, and something that encompasses everything is infinite, and something that's infinite is way beyond anything that little brain box can comprehend, I promise you. And, you know, everybody who tries to describe it is really lost for words through all the centuries, through all the gurus, saints, prophets, etc. And, yeah, a lot more people are tapping into it now on very different levels in very different ways. Of course, it's all unique to the individuals, depending on what station they want to pick up on. And because there's infinite variations, you can pick up on so many different infinite variations of it. You know, one of the biggest things that I've started to realize about it more often now is the tremendous amount of humbleness and humility that kind of affects you when you are in that space. I don't know how to put it. You feel very humbled.
Why do you think that is?
I mean, I asked the stream that question.
Mm.
And they put it down, if I remember correctly, to contrast. They said that it was contrast, and that I'm still thinking about that. And I don't really have an answer. I mean, that's why I asked them the question. I don't really have an answer to that. And I like not having answers.
All right, good. Well, then
it allows for more expansion and more openness to anybody coming up with something. Some of the listeners who are listening may have a better idea of what it is and give me an idea. And, you know, anybody, you know, I'm just open. I want to be open to the next step and next step. I'm always growing. I mean, you probably listened and watched me along the show. I've always changed. I come up with new things, new ways, and new ideas.
Sure.
And, you know,
well, it's one of the reasons we keep inviting you back, just because you keep going like that. So it makes it interesting.
Thank you.
You know?
Thank you. You know, if I keep on saying the same things again and again the same way, you know, everybody runs away. It's just the way it is. Mm-hmm. I often watch the children when they react in the same way again and again. You just get totally bored and they don't get any reaction. And then, of course, they golf and they try something new and then you get interested again. And, you know, it's the same with everything in life. You know, you need to reinvent yourself. As, you know, a website, if it's not rehashed every 3 years, reinvented or redesigned, really loses public appeal hugely. So, you know, every 3 years, most companies are tweaking, even though they might not see it massively. I've seen it with YouTube recently. They've done a lot of things, huge amount of things.
That's an interesting thing. Let's stay on that for just a moment, because the way I'm seeing it, there are two different ways that kind of phenomenon gets looked at. Mm-hmm. On the one hand, we have the people who don't like change. They like things to stay the same. I'm thinking of my wife at this particular moment in time, who just can't stand any kind of technological change because it means she has to learn a new interface and she doesn't like learning new interfaces. And part and parcel with that is something that maybe on the surface doesn't sound like it connects, but I think it connects pretty clearly. And that is the concept of propaganda. Propaganda is basically messaging that gets repeated over and over and over again. Usually it's false messaging, but it doesn't really matter whether it's false or true. The fact that it gets repeated is what makes it become believable. What we focus our attention on over and over again becomes a belief, and that's what happens with propaganda. Well, people very easily fall into the propagandistic receiver mode. And they stay there for long, long periods of time. Eventually, people can get to the point where they've had enough of it. And then that surprising change that you mentioned happens. But I don't see that you have a whole bunch of people leaning one direction or leaning the other. It's like they're leaning both ways. Some people are leaning this way. Some are leaning that way. Some are very receptive to propaganda. Some people are very receptive to living in that same space. Some people are very receptive to the idea of keeping the interface the same. And other people, they're just the opposite. They want that interface to change. They want the messaging to change. They want to jump out of that comfort zone or that familiar zone or whatever you want to call it. So what do you think about that?
Well, if you understand the law of attraction, so when you focus on anything, you're going to amplify it.
Right.
And of course, when you know what you don't want strong enough, you get a good idea what you do want. And then mm-hmm. sometimes you make the jump into what you do want. And that's all you're talking about. It really is that simple. And, you know, if some people want to stay with what they don't want, as Abram says, it's just going to get bigger and bigger.
Yep.
So, you know, there's a solution at the end of everyone. You know, there's a light at every tunnel.
There is.
Whichever way you go. So, you know, eventually you get to a stage where you really don't care about other people, not because there's not a human caringness for them, but because you know nothing's going wrong. You truly understand that. So you don't have to worry about Walt, but you can get excited about Walt.
Mm-hmm. Yep, that's true.
You know, I can get excited about you getting more and more depressed because I can see there's a light at the end of that tunnel.
I can see you do that, actually, by the way. Just saying.
So
I know my Louis very well.
And then you don't carry the world on your shoulders and you realize it's not your responsibility. You completely get it. There is no illusions left anymore. They're all gone when it comes to carrying the world or carrying other people or all the rest of it. And,
except for the book by Richard Bach, but that's a smart ass answer. So,
why? What does he say? Yes.
The book's called Illusions. You said there aren't any illusions left. There's a whole book.
When you know what you don't want, you have a better idea what you do want. It's a great title. Nothing's going wrong there. you get very, very involved in the journey as opposed to any destination. You just really flow with it. You know, my daughter said to me, I was like getting grumpy with her, and she says, "Now you're laughing. Why'd you change so quickly?" I said, "Because I don't like staying grumpy for long."
Good answer, said, oh, too.
Okay.
Yeah.
And, you know, I learned also, I don't know if it was a trick or what my dad did or what he didn't do, but every time he was grumpy or serious with me, I realized that he wasn't serious underneath it all. He was just putting on a persona. And once I realized that, I was like absolutely thrown, because my whole life I'd really thought Dad was extremely serious and strict person, but underneath it all, he didn't care at all. It didn't bother him in the slightest. And then I realized, oh, okay, so he's just playing out a father figure role, but underneath it all,
he's a marshmallow. Acting.
Yeah, he's having fun, you know. He's playing the game of being daddy, and we were playing the game of being kids.
Mm-hmm.
And everything's happy at the home front. And, you know, I really realize it with my kids, because I feel like a kid totally, you know.
And that's cool.
I act with them. I roll on the floor with them. I tickle them. I joke with them. I laugh with them. And it's so difficult for me to see me as a 53-year-old male, you know. I just don't see it. I don't visualize it at all. It doesn't even appear. So,
other than changes that I see when I look at myself physically in the mirror, I stopped feeling like there was any real difference in myself by around age 30. Mm-hmm. In terms of, you know, I just feel like the same person. I feel like I've matured in a sense. I have grown, but I still feel like, I mean, I understand now the comment that my grandmother made to me when I was quite young. She was in her 80s at the time, I think. And she made the comment that she felt like she was 23. Now, she was fairly active. She walks like 5 or 6 miles a day. So she was not in decrepit shape or anything like that, but she clearly did not have the body of a 23-year-old, but she felt like she did. And I really thought about that one a lot. In fact, the way she expressed it was, how did she say it? It something like that. She felt like a 23-year-old trapped in an 80-year-old body or something along that line. And that just kind of really stuck with me. And I think I adopted the viewpoint a little bit pretty early in life, so that maybe that explains why it is that, you know, at age 30, I felt like, okay, I feel like I'm still 30. In fact, I'll tell you, for years, like for the next 30 years, I didn't celebrate the new age of my birthday. It was always the anniversary of my 30th birthday. And that's one of the reasons why, because I didn't feel any different. I felt the same. I felt like I was the same human being. No big difference.
30 was a big one for me. I went through a bit of a horror story, a psychological drama. This is the language I like using at the moment, at the age of 30, thinking, oh, I'm not a youth anymore. I can't join the youth groups. I can't.
Yeah, I had a bit of that at 32, actually.
Yeah, and it was quite a shock for me. I was like, oh, but I mean, 50 was nothing. You know, any of the other ages was nothing. It's just that 30. Yeah, it's just what it is. And because of the energy work and, you know, keeping myself fairly active, my body's in very good shape, which I love. And I like keeping it that way. And I have so much respect for the body that, you know, I'm always, you know, anything that I do to stress it, I work to unstress it. So I'm always playing with the contrast of stressing and unstressing the body. Although the mind, ever since LOA, has been very much relaxed.
It's a nice feeling, isn't it?
Relaxed. But I still see the mind playing, bringing up old things. Now, it's not bringing the bad old things up anymore, but it's just bringing up old things.
Sure.
They don't bother me. They don't affect me. There's no negative emotional connotation to them anymore. But I still see it dredging them up. And so I'm still looking to become a better director of my mind. I want to create a cleaner movie for myself. And I've just become so aware of the psychological dramas that people play and how it is all up to the directors as to how it affects them and how they play the game. So very little comes from external influence.
This actually ties into that second email I mentioned, the one from Sarah. Because she's starting to touch on, in her email, some of the things that we're kind of approaching here. And I think if I bring in her email, we'll be able to get there pretty quickly. She says, hi, Walt and crew. I'm investigating modalities for achieving what Lily calls relief and release, modalities that allow limiting beliefs to be released, creating space and relaxation. The ones I've got my eye on now are, 1, sound healing with or without tuning forks. 2, craniosacral therapy. 3, access bars. I was wondering if any of your co-hosts had knowledge of one or more of these, or if guest experts could be called upon for that purpose. It would be awesome if any or all of them could be elaborated on in the show as thoroughly as you did with Jinshin Jitsu in the past, which you devoted like 6 episodes to with guest expert Astrid Kaufman. I rejoice already for the learning to come. Much appreciation, Sarah. So since she addressed you with your term relief and release, I figure I'll give you the first shot at it.
Cool. Let's talk about cranial sacral.
Okay.
So you get an osteopath. You get a what do you got? There's guys that click your bones?
Chiropractor?
You get a chiropractor, then an advanced chiropractor. That's the way I look at it. Somebody will disagree, I'm sure. Advanced chiropractor is an osteopath. And an osteopath, if they're a good one, does cranial sacral.
Okay.
Now, cranial sacral is taking your fingers, putting them in the back of the neck, touching certain points, and your whole body will jerk. Mm. And you'll get this relief and release going down the body. And they know it's like playing a piano in the back of your neck. There, they can just hit these points and you get quite shocked if you're getting a big release. So it's incredibly powerful and it's not to be underestimated. And I'll tell you a story. So, you know, I had this hernia operation, and afterwards I was in a real mess. I've spent a whole episode on the story, which I strongly recommend anybody who hasn't heard it go and listen to that whole.
It was good. Yeah, it was a good story. Yeah.
It was quite an incredible experience. So, one thing I didn't bring up there was going to the osteopath who I'd been going to before and had a huge amount of respect for instinctively.
Mm-hmm.
This woman knew what she was doing completely, totally, and absolutely. She worked from home. She never advertised. Everybody that she ever had was word of mouth.
Mm.
And I got on the insurance and I started going for consistent treatments with her, and she really helped. She didn't speak much. She just knew exactly what she was doing. But I've had this operation and I'm a huge mess. My whole body is so tense in so many different levels and so many different ways. My back was all completely out. And I went into her office and she took one look at me and said, I think you should go to the hospital or something. I said, no, you are who I need to go to. I was absolutely focused and determined and clear that I needed to go to her. And she looked at me and said, okay, we'll try. And she got me on the table, put me in this position. And she went, I was really weak and I was really in a lot of tenseness. So muscles were pulling my spine out of place all over the place.
Right.
So it was a complete bundle of tension. And I had the strong call to go to her. And she ushered me in, looked at me, all the rest of it, put me on the table, got me in the position, and then she went, and every single vertebra from the tail all the way to the top clicked. And I was like, wow, that's amazing. That's amazing. It just feels so much better. You know, I mean, it took me a while because it was such a relief. It was a bit overwhelming.
But, right.
The point I wanted to make is I said to her, I was amazed that every vertebra cracked. She said, I'm not amazed every vertebra cracked. She said, I'm amazed that it actually cracked. So she understood the body so well that she realized that the issue was for me is, will I allow my body to get the crack or won't I? That mm-hmm. was the big issue for her. That was the clarity she had. The clarity right. I had was, wow, it clicked every single vertebra from my base to the top. That's just amazing. So, you know, she was really clear. And then she did some cranial sacral on me and she loosened up a lot of the other points on the back, and that was enough for me for that one session. And I never went back to her. I don't think I've ever been back to her from that day.
Wow.
It sorted everything out for me.
Wow.
I knew I needed to go to her then. I got it. You know, that whole story was, everything was so in sync and in tune. It was not really surprising for me, but there was a level of expectation. So I was already saying, I know this is going to work. I know I need to be here. I know now, you know, there was a lot of I knows at the time. It was huge amounts. And, so cranial sacral is very powerful. As far as I can understand, you can't do it on yourself. I mean, I've tried and I've got absolutely nowhere, and I'm very aware and sensitive of my body. And I spend a huge amount of time working on it. Still today, every evening and night, I'm working on some aspect of my body energetically.
Mm.
And, you know, I'll be playing with the liver one day and I'll be playing with the kidney on another one. And I'll be playing with the spleen and I'll be playing with the one flow or the two flow or the 15 flow and making myself laugh. And, you know, because it's a happiness and joy point, etc. And so when you've got the tools of Jin Shin Jitsu, you really can go out there and play with them. The other one she talked about was sound. So I've got a Tibetan bowl. It's a huge one. It's about that size. And it's made of 7 different layers of metal, very specifically designed. And it's got this beautiful resonant sound. Maybe I'll bring it on the show next time.
Hmm. Is it like what they call a sing bowl?
Yeah, it's a singing bowl, but mm-hmm. it's one of those copper ones as opposed to the glass ones you get.
Both. Right, right. Yeah.
And you just take a piece of wood around the side, hold it at the bottom, and it just makes this incredible sound. And of course, sound and sound therapy is very, very therapeutic. Sound is a vibration. The vibrations flow through the body. So you've got a whole lot of vibrations as a human body, and your thoughts and your past and all the rest of it. And the thing. Okay. Let's finish off with this, because we can go into that later.
Okay.
I just wanted to talk about briefly later on, maybe the different vibrations that makes up a human. There's numerous of them, and worth maybe a discussion at some stage. So you've got the sound, and the sound is affecting your vibration because it's a vibration and it's going through your vibration. So, and often it's of a cleansing nature because it's a very, so there's, even when they make these bowls, they, you know, they're handmade and you can see that they hit there with a little hammer. You can see still the little hammer marks on all the different points and they molded it in there. So there's a lot of time and effort and focus and clarity in making these bowls.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And there's a level of symbology, or you could say that the bowl has an energy of its own, a sacred Many energy.
Mm-hmm.
And that energy is transmitted. It's created on a fairly high level of purity if it's done correctly. And that energy is transmitted into you. If they machine made bowls, I don't know how effective they will be. There will be a level of effect. But if you get one of the proper Buddhist meditation bowls and they've actually infused it with source energy, then you have something that is of immense power and well worth using. Now,
Do you have any idea how they do that? How do they actually infuse it with source energy? And the reason I ask
very few people can do that. So I'm making a statement based on my more recent understanding. If quantum touch, I'll wing you a video on quantum touch. So this guy. Okay. Just to bring you into current world. Now, the Egyptians used to do this. They used to do it to the staff, and they put the staff on your arm, and they focused on it in the way that they could do because they infused that staff in the first place. But the staff was so clear, pure, positive energy that when they used their own energy to channel this pure, positive energy into you, broken bones would heal, wounds would heal. They'd be able to do absolutely unbelievable things with the staff in the old Egyptian days. But there's going back to this quantum touch guy, Graham, I think his name is Gordon. Gordon has found an ability to channel his healing abilities, the ones that he's good at. One thing he can do is he can just touch your head. And what it does is it aligns the bones in your head. And he does it. He's done it with triple blind studies. He's done it with scientists. He's done it, you know, he does it in front of people. So, you know, your nose is slightly skew and this is slightly here. And then my glasses are still, because my ears are a bit, you know. So he can touch the skull and he can align them. And he's very good at the alignment of the skull. So he's taken the few things that he's very good at and he's infused it in an item. And he tried different items. He tried plastic and he tried wood and he tried different types of metals and all the rest of it. And he found something that works fairly well to maintain it. And then he sent this thing to different ones of his healers who are good at different areas. And he got them to infuse it. Now, he sells this thing, so there's a commercial aspect. So you can go, wah, wah, wah. Or you can say, maybe. So what he's done is if you take this thing, put it on your body, and you as a healer who doesn't have the ability to align the skull, you can take the skull of somebody and align them because you're now tapping into the energy, not necessarily source energy, because I don't think it has the power to fix bones and, you know, do what the Egyptian one's done. But he's starting on a scale that is, man is starting to learn how to infuse items again. And I mean, Indians have been doing it for centuries.
Mm-hmm.
This
idea of infusing an object, it sounds to me very much like what I would call tuning. Like it's being tuned at a particular frequency, so to speak.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Mm. And the reason I bring that up is my understanding of source energy is that everything's made of source energy. So when somebody talks about infusing something with source energy, my reaction is, well, doesn't it already have some?
No, I understand that. So you understand the difference between energy and resonant frequency, or frequency and resonant frequency.
And that's why I thought of the idea of tuning it. Yeah,
tuning, exactly. And that's what I was bringing in the aspect. So what they're doing is they're getting it to vibrate at that really high frequency because they've tapped into that specific one. You know, there's a specific one to align the skull. There's a specific one for this, for the kidney, a specific one for the liver, there's a specific one. So, yeah, a lot of people are starting to do this now, and it's really, really exciting and interesting because, you know, the Indians, the southern Indians, interestingly enough, I didn't realize the difference between southern India and northern India in connection with spirituality.
Spirituality, I have no idea.
Mostly been in the south.
Okay.
And the south haven't been invaded by all the north and all other places, and they've kept their wealth, their tradition, and their understanding kind of secular and focused for a lot longer than other areas and things like that, which I didn't quite understand. I'm kind of learning that at the moment. But they've been infusing objects and using them forever, forever.
And I take you've actually experienced an infused object, it sounds like it, from the way you're talking. What's it like?
So the object I've experienced is actually just a rock.
Okay.
On a mountain.
Okay. Well, it makes it a little bit tough on the shipping charges, but other than that,
you know. It does, yeah. You can go send this rock, guys. I don't even know if I can tell you how to get there anymore. I could probably just find my way back. What sitting on this rock did, looking over this beautiful valley on a peaceful day by myself, was, you could say, almost like the earth energy is like a fire just built up inside me. Weird. Did somebody sit there and meditate once upon a time and infuse it with their own source energy? To me, more than likely. That's the kind of feeling I got about it, but I can't prove any of this. You know, and I don't intend to.
But it also kind of reminds me of the stories that you hear about people who visit Machu Picchu, the energies that they're feeling there. And it made me, as we're talking here, it made me wonder, are they experiencing energies that are tuned by, I don't know, by nature, by some entities that live in the area? I don't know exactly what, but the stories have enough similarity to what we're talking about here that it makes me wonder.
Was listening to somebody talking about that recently, and I can't remember how they said it was infused, but I have a feeling that they know, and I'll go back and listen to it. But they said on the mountain there are a lot of six-sided stones.
Okay.
And it's very unique to that area and that place, and this energy is of such a nature that it creates five or six-sided stones, which surprised me. You know, the kind, I can understand that a certain vibration would manifest a certain type of shape. You know, you see a lot of that. I put up, you know, in that group, that vibrational table, you know, the, I think you commented on it. So this guy rubbed a table. So he put a whole lot of beads on a table and he rubbed it with different things that made a vibration.
Right.
And you could see how it shapes those beads in different ways.
Right.
So it makes a lot of sense to me how there could be a five-sided thing, stones, et cetera, created by a very, very powerful vibration. Where is that mount, by the way? The individual who I listened to didn't mention it.
Machu Picchu? I think it's in Peru, I think.
Is it in Peru?
Okay. I think, yeah. I could be wrong about that. I've never been really clear on the geography.
So South America, basically.
You know. South America, that much I know for sure. Okay. Yeah.
So that's interesting to me. I mean, to go and experience these places for yourself. I mean, after experiencing the one place I have, I'm actually quite keen to go and experience others. But, you know, with the lockdown, I'm kind of feeling a little bit things are. But, you know, it's also not that important to me because I now realize I can tune my vibration into different stations that I can start perceiving this information firsthand within myself by tuning to a different station. So
that's where the real skill is anyway. I mean,
exactly.
the purpose of these external things is to help us get to where we're trying to get to.
But ultimately, that it can actually happen.
Well, partly that. It's also, it's kind of like a very gentle and nice feeling crutch to lean on. You know, let's let the thing do the work so I don't have to do the work.
Absolutely.
But ultimately, we're trying to learn how to do it ourselves so we don't have to have the crutch, so that we can do it without the crutch. Not that there's anything wrong with using the crutch. It's perfectly legitimate. And, you know, I use plenty of them myself. But ultimately, my goal is to get to the point.
Legitimate. When is the crutch not legitimate?
When it's stopping you from walking normally.
when if you take away the crutch, you fall down.
Okay.
So what we're saying is that if you need a candle to meditate, if you don't have a candle, you can't meditate.
Mm.
If you need incense to meditate, if you don't have incense, you can't meditate.
Mm-hmm.
So okay. Once it becomes a crutch, that is when it is of no value to you anymore. When it is helping you become aware and meditate for the first time, start experiencing things, that's great. But once you take it away and you can't do with it anymore, it's like, when do you know is caffeine any good for you or not good for you anymore? When you wake up in the morning, say, must have my fix. Then you know that caffeine is of no good for you. To me, caffeine has no effect on me whatsoever. I can drink as much coffee as I want and go straight to sleep.
On the other hand, I could also make the argument that the caffeine has a very great value along the lines of what you've talked about, because now you know what you don't want. So, yeah, and you know it really, really well because you got the shakes.
Yeah. So, you know, it's important to understand when something is of value and when it's not. So this lady, what was her name again?
The writer, the email is Sarah.
Sarah. So Sarah is talking about external things. Now, the thing I don't like about chiropractors, osteopaths, etc. Now, note I said I went to her once and I never went to her again. Okay.
Right.
I could go to before. But as I increased my awareness and my own abilities and my understanding of my body, the ability to heal myself was so predominant that to outsource it anymore is not that important. Now, I'm not saying I might go through the need of a doctor or something in the future. That could well happen. but I will be taking 99.99% of the responsibility and giving them a little bit that they need to do.
I kind of consider medical personnel to be spotters, like for a gymnast. You know, the spotter actually is not there to catch you every time. It's just to help you just in case you falter.
Absolutely. And if more people took it that way, because, I mean, you've got the NHS in the UK. So, I don't have to worry about my health. I just go on the NHS if something goes wrong.
Yeah, that's a good attitude. Mm.
It is a great handicap for a nation to have that. That net, so you don't fall.
It's got two sides to it. On the one hand, it's a handicap. On the other hand, it's a benefit. The question is, which way are we going to deal with it?
You know, if it wasn't there, I mean, like America, you have to pay a fortune for health insurance, I think. At least that's the impression we get from over here. I don't know how much is free. Is anything free over there?
It's in flux right now, and it would probably take too long to go into the great level of detail about it, but let's just put it this way. It is until it isn't.
Okay. I really want to encourage people to take more responsibility for their own health. And that requires you to study and understand the body, which means you need to understand why you're here and where you're going, which is... You need to understand the mind clearer. You need to understand the energies of the body. You need to start coming to a grasp on many different levels to be effective in your confidence, to be able to deal with more things yourself. And it's a journey, and it's probably the most exciting and the most valuable one I can suggest anybody goes out and tries. So, you know, give it a whirl.
Yeah, there's a lot to be said for it. Because I chose the spotter analogy deliberately because it involves a gym, which is ironic because I hate gyms. I have no interest in going to gyms at all. But it's a very useful analogy because what we're talking about with a gym is you're working on building your body. You're working on strengthening muscles and improving posture and all the other stuff. And the same thing is true when you're working on your body spiritually. It's just that you're not necessarily doing it in a gymnasium. But you're still doing work on yourself. Yeah, you probably have a spotter nearby or somebody who you're talking to for advice and so forth. But the goal and the journey, the practice of it is about learning, like what you do, learning how your body works, learning how to interact with it, how to tune it to its best place to be in, learning how to appreciate it, learning what it's trying to tell you, learning how to listen to it. And as all that develops, if you're applying yourself to accomplishing the goal of learning it, understanding it, interacting with it, getting better at dealing with it and so forth, you get stronger, just like you get stronger when you're working in a gym. It's just that in this case, the strength is more of a mental and emotional and spiritual one rather than physical muscles. Although I guess it could be that too.
Yeah. I mean, and guess what? Your entire being, all your five physical senses become more fine-tuned.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, sure.
And
because you're using them.
Experience of life is enhanced.
Mm. Very much so. Yeah, and that's what we're really talking about when we're talking about this broad subject of LOA and energy and so forth. Because why do people come into it? They want to get control of their lives. They want to get control of the results of their lives and the journeys of their lives and what's happening in their lives. Well, that's a hands-on experience, isn't it?
Absolutely.
You don't really get there by having it. I think I'm going to go in and have the doctor hand me this wonderful life that I want. It doesn't work that way. I don't care what.
Come on, take this tablet.
Living.
When you're depressed, right. You take it. When you're happy, when you're too happy, you take it.
I think I'd rather follow the kindergartners. You know, when you're happy, you know it. Clap your hands. Yeah, that to me is a better way to do it.
I love it.
Oh my goodness. Well, those are two really good emails, so thank you. And Sarah, I will definitely hang on to yours and share it with some other co-hosts to see what their takes are. I can't honestly say I'm thinking of any experts off the top of my head, although, Louis, you might be able to come up with somebody. But if we can find somebody, we'll bring it in.
The lady is retired, the one that worked on me. Otherwise, I've always wanted, you know, and I've thought about getting her on the podcast. I could probably go knock on her door and see if she still lives there. Her name was Marge or Maggie, Marge. I don't know. One of those.
She might appreciate it. You never know.
Her surname was Till Marge. And because you're only there for a short period and it's all paid and all the rest of it, you don't have the time to talk to her. But I knew she knew so much. I was just curious as to how much she could verbalize. You know, some people are just able to do it and not able to verbalize anything.
Right.
You just don't know. So I wanted to go and maybe ask her one stage. You know, it's been in the back of my mind forever. So maybe I will. Because she was what I would consider. I mean, I sent my Jinshin Jitsu teacher to her. And she said she was amazing. You know, she's so sensitive. My Jinshin Jitsu teacher, and when she went to her, the lady said, "I'm not going to crack you." She said, "Great, I'm glad you understand," without telling her that this would be too much for her body to be able to crack and get those shock things. She knew it, so she did just very small manipulations on her, which was just perfect for her.
Mm-hmm.
So to the degree that without even letting her know, she knew that this person was too sensitive to crack. And, you know, there's not many people out there that can do that. I just, you know, I crack. That's my job.
Yeah, that's why I never went to chiropractors. I do not like that process at all. I go out of my way to do anything except that, if possible.
Well, you misunderstand what's happening. So the reason the spine gets pulled out of place is because of tension in the muscles.
Oh no, I understand that.
No. I'm just pointing out for the people out there.
Oh, okay.
So the reason why you get tension in the muscles in different areas is because you're thinking. So
that's true.
You've got to see the circle of what's going on here.
Yep.
and then you can start doing something about it. But if nobody points the circle out to you,
it's true. I guess. Also, I look at kind of the way Abraham recommends looking at it. I look at it and I say, how does it feel to me? And my answer is, it doesn't feel very good. And so my response is, okay, I'm not going there. Mm. Real simple. About as simple as you can get.
But then one day, if you're open enough, even though you have this prejudice,
is it a prejudice or is it a preference?
This is why it might be a prejudice. If you were guided to go to somebody like Maggie, who does do that, but she's that level of sensitive that she would know exactly what to do for your body, then you might say, oh, yes, under those circumstances, I could go to somebody like that. So I like to continuously remain open about those things.
I would not be closed to the idea at all. I'm telling you
I'm just being devil's advocate here.
I know you are, and I'm being devil's advocate right back. That's what makes this whole conversation work so well. Don't you know that? But seriously, I mean,
I'm scared I'm going to hurt your feelings, Walt.
Yeah, there's not too much risk there, I don't think. At some point, you have to recognize, you know, the feelings aren't there to be touched, so don't worry about it. But I'm making a serious point, well, semi-serious, that anytime that I am responding to something, I'm responding to it based on what my immediate impression is, whether it be sensory or whether it be some sort of internal feeling or whatever. Mm-hmm. And certainly that feeling can change from moment to moment. I think what will never really change is, or let's put it this way, what I'm deliberately transitioning to, let's put it that way, I'm transitioning to, with intention, only going with those things that feel good to me and away from those things that don't feel good to me. And I don't necessarily base it on whether or not they felt good to me in the past, although that certainly is, you know, an indicator. I mean, we all do that pretty regularly. I know I do. But I'm also doing it based on what's the signal I'm getting right now. The reason I bring this up is we've talked about this in other contexts here on the show on the other days. It's the same concept as signs. You know, you're traveling along the road and you see a sign. The sign says New York 100 miles. And then 100 miles later, you say, let's see, it's about 100 miles to New York. Oh, wait a minute. I mean, it just missed the exit. Now, of course, there are about 25 exits for New York, so you don't have to really worry about that. But maybe the example would be Oshkosh, you know, some little tiny town that you're trying to get to. And then you miss it because, well, it was 100 miles. Well, that was 100 miles ago. The question is, what are the current signs telling you? And so that's why I've never really been particularly interested in signs for one thing, because the sign is what used to be, not what's currently going on. Mm-hmm. To me, the more interesting question is, what are the signals that I'm getting rather than a sign? Because a signal is going to be, it's going to be current. Signals get transmitted over currents, and a current is current. It's right now. It's in the present tense. So anything that I'm looking at is going to be like that. And if I look at, you know, if I'm dealing with a health issue that I don't know, I might just go to an osteopath. I actually have gone to an osteopath a long time ago, and it was worth the visit, and I've never gone back, similar to you. Even though she told me if I didn't change, I was going to be diabetic by the time I was, well, actually my age right now. Sorry, it didn't work out.
What was the problem that she, and why did she come to that conclusion?
I can't describe that in a minute. Just can't.
That's really too much. I mean, when I hear a statement like that, I'm all over it like a rash. It's like, I want to dig into this. I want to see the logic where they came from and why they made these conclusions.
You can see that I had a good reason not to go back to her, but that's another topic.
Absolutely. Cairo talking about you getting diabetes. That's interesting.
Yeah, or osteopath, actually. But yeah.
An osteo, yeah. I mean, yeah. Either.
Mm. But that's a rather curious and humbling and humorous spot to stop. So we'll just kind of draw to a close there. But thank you very much. It's been a great discussion. And looking forward to getting Amy back next week. But I think you held Amy's role as well as your own very, very well. So congratulations on that. me. All right, very good. Thank you very much. Thank you to our podcast listeners. We'll see you all next time here on LOA Today. Goodbye, everybody.
Thank you.